from hell surprise. Cosmic Cummies arrived. 12 transmission steel buys the seats where science, myth, and magic meet. From 61 into the 70, exponential growth only in humanity. I'm a bad one.
It's incredible!
I'm a bad one.
Hey there, and welcome to Marvel by the Month, the podcast that takes you through the history of Marvel Comics one month at a time. In this episode, that month is September of 1967. My name's Brian Stratton.
And mine is Rob Milne.
Rob, it is 2 days to Christmas.
Time travel.
Just,
I forget
come
about
on, man.
Taping early. I'm so
Be
bad
in
at
the
this.
Moment with me.
It is. Oh, good.
Yeah.
For Christmas.
Do you feel like you have been a good boy this year?
I mean, it depends on your criteria, man. That's what
right.
I told Santa every time I sat on his lap, recently.
It gets creepy after 35.
For him. I mean, I'm fine.
Yeah. Yeah. What's on your wish list this year?
You know, I have not given it a single thought. Mostly my wish list is to, hug my friends and, just be able to have band practice again would be pretty awesome.
Yeah.
Like I'd have my bar is super low at this point. Go to a restaurant sounds cool. I haven't really given it a ton of thought, and everything else, you know, comics wise, I've been supporting our local shops. So I'm backlogged I'd say a 4-foot stack of collections right now.
Yeah, no, I think I'm in the same boat with you. I think my number one wish is just for a safe and reliable vaccine as soon as possible. And then, I mean, this is kind of my wish literally every week of my life now, but I wish for an entertaining guest with broadcast skills who can carry us to a halfway decent show.
But you've been doing okay with landing some guests, but I mean, can you keep that up? Is that sustainable?
I think so. I think I got another winner here. Let me introduce him to you. He is a prolific actor. He's an improv comedian and a podcaster. You have heard him on Thrilling Adventure Hour and Welcome to Night Vale. And he's the co-host of We Got This with Mark and Hal, with Mark Gagliardi, and Tyson Fights with Danielle Radford and Mike Eagle. Hal Lublin, thanks for joining us on Marvel by the Month.
Ho, ho, ho. Sorry, that was me being dropped off by Santa.
Oh,
hello.
How lucky. You've got the inside connection.
I do. I'm really, yeah. Like every entirely Jewish child raised in Philadelphia, I know Santa personally. I'm not afraid to pull those strings, especially 2 days until Christmas.
Yes.
Well, I think what's great about that is that he knows that you're not hitting him up for something. So, you know, it's like every other kid, he has to kind of look at him as like, okay, you know, you're just putting on a show for me right now. But it's like, if you don't celebrate Christmas, you have just an entirely friendly relationship.
Yeah, yeah, I'm not knocking on his door asking him for toys or trips anywhere. I just want to know how he is.
Yeah.
And that stands for a lot. Do I get toys? Does he take me places? Yes. Is that the point of it? No, it's just a friendship. I'm not working the angle here. That's not who I am.
And, you know, he's still good to me, even though I've don't really go along with any of the Saint stuff. I understand. And it's good to know that he's also a Lyft driver in, you know, up until Christmas Day. So that's what I assumed when you said he dropped you off.
Oh, he's OG. He doesn't have the mustache light. He has the dirty, fuzzy mustache on the front of his sleigh. That's how you know he's day one.
Oh, amazing. Hal, let's get the plugs out of the way straight off the bat. You host two awesome podcasts on the Maximum Fun Network. We Got This with Mark and Hal. And Tights and Fights. For our listeners who may not be familiar with them, can you just tell us a little bit about the two shows?
Sure. We got this with Mark and Hal as my thrilling adventure, fellow Work Juice player Mark Gagliardi from Drunk History and Blood and Treasure, and I taking the things you argue with your friends about that aren't really important. It's not religion or politics or anything like that. And we settle them once and for all. So whether or not ketchup goes on a hot dog, that was our first one. Toilet paper over or under. We've done best Star Wars movie. We sort of run the gamut. So that's been going on. We just a week or so ago had our 300th episode.
Congratulations. Wow.
Thank you. We're still finding things that people argue about. And then Tights and Fights is myself and Daniel Radford and Lindsay Kelk and Open Mike Eagle, when he can drop in, talking about pro wrestling, not just breaking down what happened in a week, but talking about larger issues and themes through the lens of social justice and three people who enjoy making jokes.
What made you decide to do a wrestling podcast?
I've been a wrestling fan since I was a kid, since I remember watching a televised match of Hulk Hogan winning the title off of the Iron Sheik, and I was hooked. I was just the right age to sort of grow up with it. Then mm-hmm. I went away for a while, came back in the mid-90s when it was at its worst, then back again during the Attitude Era, and then I was here to stay.
Nice.
So I wanted to do a wrestling podcast, and I talked to Travis McElroy about it. And he said, Jesse's going to start a maximum. Email Jesse and see if he can get in on it. And that's how it happened. And I also want to throw in a third podcast in there, which is Good Morning Night Vale, which is myself, Symphony Sanders, and Meg Bashwinner re-listening to Welcome to Night Vale and going episode by episode and doing recaps and behind-the-scenes stuff. All the plugs are now out there.
All three of them are great podcasts. I have an especially soft spot in my heart for Tights and Fights. In a previous life, I used to work with WWE on their wrestling video games. I used to do the scripts and the storylines for a few years' worth. And I have not watched wrestling regularly since then. But I really love dropping in on Tights and Fights. I feel like you guys kind of watch wrestling so that I don't have to, which I think is what we kind of do for some people.
For Silver Age comics.
Yes. Yeah. But it's terrific. And I feel like there's a lot of crossover also between wrestling and superhero culture and fandom.
For sure.
I feel like, you know, like pro wrestling is basically about as close as you're ever going to see to like a live action theatrical performance of a superhero story.
Yeah, it's no coincidence that so many, especially so many modern wrestlers are such huge fans of comics, and you can see them adopt a lot of different types of pop culture, but comics especially, in the ring attire they have, from people dressing like Harley Quinn to people dressing like Heath Ledger's Joker back in 2008, 2009.
Mm-hmm.
Those influences, they continue to, I think, influence one another. And I do want to say that the thing that got me back into wrestling in 2000 was playing SmackDown on the PlayStation.
Oh, nice.
So that video games was my way back in, so...
Very cool. Well, I did the storylines and scripts for the first couple years of the SmackDown versus Raw games. So
yeah.
The first PS2 games. So,
I remember them well.
Yeah. I have nothing other than recently going to Roddy Piper's grave here in near Portland.
Was he still there?
He was. He haunted them. Yeah, he looked. I had to put on my glasses, and then I could see him as a zombie.
Yes.
But I Brian's far more into wrestling. But as a kid, I was we had Portland wrestling here, so we had the touring come through. I saw Andre the Giant when I was a kid, and he was bigger than my family, and I'm 6'5" now and shrinking rapidly, but so seeing a human being that large, just so dramatic and cool and funny made me really impressed. And we went as often as we could, and of course Roddy Piper is a hometown hero here in Portland, so I adore it, and that's how Brian and I really hit it off when he told me he wrote the scripts and got to write, how do you say, like a dozen different ways somebody can cry out when they're hit by a chair.
Yeah. The way I described that job was like, it's finding 50 different ways for one person to want to hit another person with a chair, which sounds a lot easier than it is. It's like you run out of them like after about 9 or 10.
It's like raising the bar on supervillains in the comics. Yeah. Like once you hit Galactus, you know, it's hard to go beyond that. So what's your reason for an ultimate, a nullifier at that point, or, you know, a chair.
Right.
It just gets hard to do.
So Hal, what's your level of like superhero comics fandom? Are you a comics guy? Are you a movie guy?
I'm both. My dad has been a comic book collector my entire life and before that. So I inherited that love from him. I read a lot of Silver Age DC when I was younger. And even before that, a lot of Archie and Sugar and Spike. Like I graduated then to DC, then to Marvel. I remember reading a lot of the Dark Phoenix stuff when I was like 12, 13, when they started to republish it as Classic X-Men. And then I started to go back and collect stuff. And then my dad got into it. And what would happen is anytime I was collecting something, if it was baseball cards or comic books, my dad would get into it. And all of a sudden, within 3 months, we would have our own table at conventions selling stuff, and the fun would be gone from it because all of a sudden it became work. But I always loved the characters, loved the movies. I'm a huge MCU fanatic, and I know enough about what has happened in the comics to be dangerous, but I'm still going back now and reading what's happened in the last 20, 30 years, just sort of selectively grabbing storylines. It's funny how your memory, if you were not doing this, let's call it a project, if you're not doing this show and going, you've now covered 6 years worth of Marvel Comics in the last 2 years. Is that right?
Yep.
So there are probably things that you remembered before you went back to really reread them that you had a strong positive memory of. This was great. This was such an epic moment. And then when you read it, it sort of loses its luster because you've built it up so much. And yet there's something significant happening in most comics. Something significant has happened at some point over in any issue, even the worst issues. Something significant may have happened that makes it noteworthy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think what I will find to that point will be, I think I'm remembering something that happened in a story that was set in 1965 or 66 or something. And what I'm actually remembering is a later writer going back and revisiting that and doing their take on it. And that's the thing that I remember being really amazing. Like when John Byrne would like revisit, you know, some like Fantastic Four lore or something like that.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that I'm like, oh, that was so epic. I'm like, and then, you know, I read it here. It's like, where was the thing that I remember? You know, this is like you gave it like three panels and you moved on to the next thing. It's almost like you're having to publish, you know, 16 comics a month and you don't have time to really think this stuff through. So, yeah. But there's also like we've discovered a lot of hidden gems. Like there's been stuff that, you know, I'd never read before we did this show and probably wouldn't have read if I hadn't come up with this insane idea. And it's been really cool kind of discovering that stuff for the first time, too. So,
well, if I may pay you both a compliment, I think you're very capable and entertaining guides through this period of Marvel history so far. So it's good. This is all the things that may annoy your friends are now an advantage here, because as a listener, it's great to be reminded of things. You know, I was talking to my wife about it earlier. I was like, I know enough about a lot of things just to be dangerous in a conversation. Probably a little bit more about Marvel than most things, but not to the depth that both of you have. So it's nice to be reminded of things and learn things as I listen.
Nice. Thank you very much. I'm looking forward to the point where we just can't go out in public anymore because not because there's a pandemic.
It's 2020.
Going on, but
you can't. There's nobody can go. And the shame will, because we all have everybody has started podcasts during the pandemic. And, and those of us who already had them, we're all going to be stuck inside just from because we can't miss the chance to talk into a microphone that will take over our lives.
This is my social life now. Yeah.
That's it.
Yep. Oh, man. Well, let's go ahead. Let's get this party started with talking about all the fun and hilarious things that were going on in September of 1967 when these issues hit the stands, some of which were about as much fun as a global pandemic. Rob, would you like to give us the update on how Vietnam is going?
Oh, boy. Thanks. Vietnam, it's September 4th, 1967. The Republican governor of Michigan, George Romney, who was considering a run for the Republican Party nomination, was asked in a televised interview why he had changed his position from support to opposition of the Vietnam War. Romney replied that when he and other American politicians were given a tour of South Vietnam in 1965, he said, "I just had the greatest brainwashing that anybody can get when you go over to Vietnam, not only by the generals, but also by the diplomatic corps." So he said, for all practical purposes, a historian would write later, that single honest remark removed Romney from serious presidential consideration. Do not say you've been brainwashed by your country's propaganda if you're running for a nomination for president.
It's a hot tip for all you presidents out there, all you future presidents. But, you know, the good news is that, and you'll get into this next episode, we really turned a corner in the fall of 67 Vietnam War. It's almost over at this point, folks. If you don't know history, don't check it. Just trust Uncle Hal. He knows.
This war will be gone by Easter. One day, it's just going to disappear.
Yep. You know, with the summer, it gets so warm that the war just ends on naturally. Wars can't sustain in warmer temperatures. Everybody knows that.
Everybody knows that.
That's science.
Couple updates on the state of racial justice in September of 1967. Oftentimes, this is the most horrifying part of the story. I have actually a couple of pretty good updates, I think, this time. The first one is a little intense, but it turns out okay. September 4th, in Centerville, Mississippi, 25 armed members of the African-American group Deacons for Defense intervened when a mob of white supremacists attempted to disrupt a demonstration for black voting rights in Wilkinson County. When one of the white members pointed a gun at the demonstrators, the deacons began unloading weapons, and wouldn't you know it, the mob dispersed without an incident. So there you go. That's the trick, apparently. And then September 6th, 1967, Walter E. Washington was appointed as the first African-American mayor of a major American city as President Lyndon Johnson announced his nomination as mayor commissioner of Washington, D.C. And here's something I didn't know. For the previous 93 years, there had been no mayor for the nation's capital. It was administered by three appointed commissioners. So there you go. D.C. gets its first mayor.
Thank goodness that mayorship solved racism, huh?
Yeah, that was it.
All done from there.
The war ended and racism solved within weeks. Within weeks, folks.
September 67 was just a magical month.
remember the month of September.
Well, in pop culture, since the Beatles are still busy finishing up Magical Mystery Tour, we'll talk about another British thing. A science fiction television series, The Prisoner, created by and starring Patrick McGoohan, premiered in Canada on September 5th, 1967. The show would not appear in the United Kingdom until September 29th, though. On the 9th, the three American television networks premiered their Saturday morning cartoon lineups on the same day. ABC featured Marvel Comics heroes with The Fantastic Four at 9:30 and Spider-Man at 10. CBS relied on DC Comics for the Superman Aquaman hour of adventure.
I don't believe that could live up to its name. Giving Aquaman billing on par with Superman?
Well, if you think about who number two is in DC, you immediately think Superman number one.
Yeah.
Yep. Really? He's the last son of Krypton is a god who walks among men.
Yep.
But second, if I had to pick just from popularity, from power set, I gotta go Aquaman.
Yep.
Gotta.
Then it's like Nightwing, and there's several others, you know, to flesh it out before you get down to the bench warmers like Batman.
Firestorm, but separated, not when they're together.
Right.
That would be number four, yeah, sure.
NBC offered Super President, in which the President of the United States, James Norcross, secretly worked as a superhero in his spare time. All the spare time of the president was taken up.
Yeah. Depending on the president.
That's true. Beats tweeting, I guess.
And golfing.
Yeah.
And golfing. And Jim Morrison of The Doors defied CBS in a live telecast of the Ed Sullivan Show on the 17th of September after initially agreeing to a producer's request to alter the lyrics to their number one hit, Light My Fire. Yeah. Morrison had been asked to change the lyric, "Girl, we couldn't get much higher," to "Girl, we couldn't get much better." Morrison sang the word anyway, and the group was banned for life from the show as a result, and were never heard from again. I know most of you have never heard of The Doors or Jim Morrison. Yeah,
that's true. Well, I have one last update from September of 67. I was looking for some wrestling news, and here's what I came up with. So on September 23rd, Polish-born wrestler Stanislaw Zbyszko, a three-time heavyweight champion in the 1920s, who was also one of the last wrestlers to win a championship in a legitimate shoot, where he was not supposed to win the match, but he just kept pinning the guy until the referee had to count it. He passed away at the age of 88. This is who Larry Zbyszko took his ring name from. Wow. There you go. There's my obscure wrestling knowledge for the month of September 1967.
The year that pinned us into submission, even though it was supposed to lose.
So that's our historical context for September 67. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about all the funny books that came out this month. So don't go away. We'll be right...
We'll be right back.
Don't
you go away. We'll be right back here on Marvel by the Month. Let's do the quick hits. Not counting fashion, romance, and Western comics or reprints, 11 Marvel comics hit the newsstands in September of 1967. We'll talk about a few of them in detail later. Here's what else came out in September of 1967. Amazing Spider-Man number 55. It's the third issue of the four-part Return of Dr. Octopus storyline, which ends with Spidey losing his memory and teaming up with Doc Ock. Daredevil number 34. Daredevil defeats the Beetle at Expo 1967 in Montreal. But not before we learn the secret origin of the Beetle. He was a mechanic in a factory who made a beetle suit. The end.
Spoiler alert.
Compelling.
Anyway, I spend definitely more time than anybody should thinking about the beetle. And his weird gloves too. His sticky, weird suction cup gloves.
Creepy little thing. Yeah.
What a jackass. I hate you, Beetle. I hate you. I hate your dumb gloves and your weird wings that don't move.
Fantastic Four number 69, we learned that the mysterious scientist who turned the Thing into a rampaging lunatic last issue was the Mad Thinker in disguise. If you couldn't figure out all of the references he dropped in interest in computers and computation and predictions, then you probably hadn't read any of these comics before. And now he's got control of the Baxter Building and the Negative Zone. So what could go wrong?
Yeah. And of course, we are still continuing our campaign to get John Hodgman named the Mad Thinker of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. So please keep the letters and postcards coming. I think we're really starting to make some progress.
Yeah. Is that because Patton is playing MODOK?
Yes. We had to come up with a fallback for him.
Well, he's also interested in Willie Lumpkin because he can move his ears. He can wiggle his ears. So he can be the mailman of the Fantastic Four.
Sure.
And save at least a million in CG. So not Brand Eck, number 5. I did not read this, and I will not read it, Brian. If you want to learn the origin of Forbush Man, you can read it. I'm still just never going to. Sergeant Fury, number 48, If Britain Should Fall. It's not on Marvel Limited, so we don't know what happened. I hope it didn't fall.
I don't know. I guess, there's no way to really know how Britain came out of World War II since that issue's not on Marvel Unlimited. So, yeah.
It almost fell, but Gerard Butler was there, and then he saved them because he was there. You know, he's the body man for the president, and he stepped in. and did Nick Fury's job for him.
We're so lucky to have him.
Mm-hmm. This is just this universe now. This timeline just keeps getting better every time we adjust. Strange Tales number 163. Nick Fury continues his battle against resurrected racist stereotype, the Yellow Claw. And there are even actual Fu Manchu references in this issue. Yeah. And Agent Clay Quartermain makes his S.H.I.E.L.D. debut, smiling all the time.
Yes.
The Living Tribunal squashes Nebulous with a planet as Doctor Strange tries to rescue Victoria Bentley.
Fill in some nonsense words here.
Get a new artist, drop some acid, draw what you think. And the story will write itself into oblivion. So, Tales of Suspense number 96, Iron Man defeats the Gray Gargoyle with the help of Jasper Sitwell, agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. After saving a bunch of guys dressed up as Captain America, Steve Rogers decides that maybe he'd better put the costume back on. So his brief break of being Captain America didn't go so well as everyone tried to fill his shoes. Very poorly. Tales to Astonish number 98, Namor tries and fails to save Atlantis from being destroyed by the Plunderer and the U.S. Navy.
Not working together.
And then the Hulk, with the Hulk under his control, the Lord of the Living Lightning takes over General Ross's army base and captures Betty Brant. So again, same sort of thing. I think General Ross and Mordo could get together and just be, have their own like little storyline, just being angry at the Hulk and angry at Doctor Strange, and they could just hang out in a just in the like an apartment. I think that would be a fine comic. It would be better than just having them constantly languish in bad storylines in these comics. But I, you know, it's we're just reading them and reporting. I'm not going to give you any editorial at all. Okay, well, Brian, let's get a little deeper now. How about that?
Okay, so I wanted to talk a little bit about X-Men number 38. This one has a main story, and then for the first time, X-Men now has a 5-page backup story like Thor does. So we'll talk about the main story first. I think it's the less interesting one, but feel free to disagree. But I think the interesting bits are all in the second story, the backup story. So anyway, we'll get the main one out of the way first. The Sinister Shadow of Doomsday was written by Roy Thomas, art by Don Heck with George Russo's. The X-Men have escaped from Factor 3's fortress, and they split into two teams to take down Factor 3. Because Factor 3 has a plan where they're going to trick the East and West into nuking each other, which, you know, in 1967, pretty good plan. So we have Marvel Girl, Beast, and Angel crashing a meeting of Eastern European military leaders to find the bomb that Factor 3 planted in their midst. They wind up fighting the Vanisher and the Blob, but the Russian military captures them all and locks them up with the bomb still ticking. So that's what they get up to. And then you've got the other team, the B team, Cyclops and Iceman, try to convince some Air Force bigwigs on a missile base that Factor 3 is trying to start a nuclear war. When they don't get anywhere with that, Plan B is to just try to destroy the missiles on the base and fight everyone on it, which doesn't go great for them. But we don't know if they succeed or not. We're just going to have to find out next month, True Believer. It was honestly, I had to read this one a couple times to actually figure out what was happening in this story. The art was kind of muddy. There was a lot of exposition. If you're not used to reading Silver Age comics, there's so many word balloons in these things.
I was going to say that there are panels where you can see like a third of a character behind all of the, it's almost like a like an airplane gag where there are so many speech balloons that you're like, is something else? Are they fighting here? Because there is so much dialogue that I know Stan Lee edits, but does he edit? Just look at it and go, this needs more words.
I think that's his version of editing. It's like, Roy, you didn't put nearly enough balloons on this page.
You know what kids love? Words they don't understand. They need to know how smart I am. The whole world needs to know how smart I am. All right, Stan. Okay.
The also adding to the confusion, the mutant master changed colors a couple of times.
Yeah.
And I was like, does he have other guys with like weird knockoff Judge Dredd helmets that are brown? I'm not sure what's happening here.
It's the way you know how he's feeling. It's a mood helet.
It's a mood helet.
That means he's sad that somebody's going to try to usurp the throne at some point. He knows.
Oh, they're not going to let him cause World War III and then clean up the, you know, remains whenever they can. Apparently, I don't know what his logic is also with this plan. I've thought a lot of supervillain plans were decent. Mm-hmm. This one is not. It's just, let's cause World War III, and then the mutants will take over once everything's rubble.
He's just chasing the shiny object. Like, he's not quite sure what's going to happen if he ever gets it. But yeah, he's like, I'll figure that out later after I've caused nuclear annihilation.
Step one.
He does establish pretty early that he's not a details guy.
That's true.
Because when he's asked, how do you think the X-Men escape? He's like, who cares? I've got a plan. I've got a big, beautiful plan, and we're going to blow everything up, and then we're going to take over. Idiot. What are you, the Beetle? The Beetle likes details, you bastard.
Yeah, so that main story, pretty forgettable. Again, I think this is just Roy just trying to get to the end of this thing, and then because he clearly wants to tell more interesting stories, because the five pager he does at the end of it, it's a third the size and like 10 times more interesting than the main story. So it's called A Man Called X. It's written by Roy Thomas. The art is by Werner Roth, with John Verputin doing the inks. And so this is where, like I said, X-Men debuts a new backup feature. The feature is called The Origins of the X-Men. So one of the things that Roy Thomas would be known for as a comics writer was going back and kind of building out the backstory of characters in the Marvel Universe and things like that. This is the first time we see him do this. He didn't invent the term retcon, but he was like one of the first people to really popularize it. So this is like Roy's first retcon. This is basically the story of how Professor X decides that he's going to try to help mutants. He hasn't built the X-Men yet, but he knows he's got to do something. So here's how he goes about it. It starts out with two FBI agents watching a news report on the panic spreading across the country as a result of mutants being discovered in local communities. Everyone's freaking out. So right off the bat, this is something that Thomas is retconning. The anti-mutant hysteria wasn't originally part of X-Men, but now he's got it as being something that was there predating X-Men number one. Like, this is always there all along. And then also, like, it kind of echoes like race riots and civil unrest that America was seeing at this time too, which is, you know, a pretty clever way to bring in an element of, you know, the real world, the world outside your window, like as Marvel was always supposed to be doing.
And it establishes, this is part of why everyone thinks that X-Men was always about this.
Yes.
Because we've been trudging along, and it took a while before there were Sentinels and the idea of, you know, the fear of mutants. And, but as I remembered as a kid, it was just always part of it. And then as we reread them, I'm like, hey, wait a minute, where is this? It looks like they were just, again, writing comics as fast as they could and moving on to the next one and with no real plan. And so now that's what he's doing, is the underpinning. Yeah.
I also want to give a shout out to the decision to make a younger Professor X look like the Star Baby from 2001, A Space Odyssey.
Yes.
His head is very oddly shaped in that way that a baby's head is shaped.
Yes.
that's how you know he's younger, though.
Yeah.
His fontanelle hasn't fused.
Yeah. He's got a soft spot up top. Nobody touch it while he's using his power. You can actually see it bubbling when he's trying to find the agent.
Grow into his forehead.
His face will catch up. It's fine. That's a five head. Hey-o.
Hey. Yeah, so, the first year and a half of X-Men had nothing to do with, like, it was not a metaphor for the civil rights struggle. Right? I mean, it was basically just the X-Men fighting Magneto repeatedly, who had weird ideas about what magnetism was. Like, that's pretty much all you had going for it. So anyway.
Professor X mind wiping everyone, which is still what he still does.
Yeah. It's what he gets off on.
I do love the extent to which Marvel kind of how they succeeded or evolved past DC in terms of trying to reflect things that were going on, whether it's starts out as just people who feel like awkward outsiders, but then how that evolved into being so woke, and then getting Magneto's backstory, which I'll bring up again later.
Mm-hmm. Oh, but nice.
I like the extent to which those matured and how long it took for DC to sort of get on that page. And I think they'll forever be trying to catch up.
Yeah. if the cinematic universe is there any indication, yes, forever.
I mean, that's the perfect. The Marvel Cinematic Universe moves forward. Meanwhile, everybody is excited for a new version of a movie that came out a couple of years ago. Yep. If they just recut Justice League, it'll be way better.
Yeah.
All right.
Good luck with that. Yeah.
So I saw a trailer for that that used Leonard Cohen's Hallelujah again. And is that an official trailer? Is that someone just taking the piss out of Zack Snyder? Because that's like his thing.
No, it's official. It's the only song they have rights to, and they're going to use it for every movie. It'll be in The Flash. It'll be in Aquaman 2. It is the only song in the Wonder Woman 84 soundtrack, which is a real shame because they missed out on a chance to use period music. Just everybody loves Leonard Cohen in the world of DC.
Yeah, nothing pairs better with slow motion punching in the face. So back to this thing. So, we've got mutants everywhere. We got mutants everywhere. Someone's got to do something about this. So meanwhile, in Westchester County, Charles Xavier is reading about the same thing that's going on. And he learns that the FBI is about to open an investigation into the mutant menace. And Xavier, I think, wisely decides he'd better get involved before things get really out of control. Because in the 60s, when the FBI opens an investigation into a group of people, doesn't always go great. So he flies himself in his helicopter to Washington, D.C., and then just kind of brain blasts his way into FBI headquarters, as he does. And he tracks down the agent who's heading up the investigation. It's Agent Fred Duncan. That's if ever there was an action hero name, it's Agent Fred Duncan. He's in his office. He's watching newsreel footage of someone who we will recognize as Scott Summers optic blasting a giant piece of machinery that's about to fall and crush a crowd of people. Xavier rolls up and says he's there to help, uses his power to show, you know, that he's for real. And then he proposes a partnership to help prevent persecuted mutants from turning against humanity. And so Agent Duncan agrees. And the deal is going to be that he's going to provide Xavier with information about suspected mutants. And Xavier is going to go sort it out and check in with him regularly with on his progress. So this kind of like retcons the origin of the X-Men into being like government contract,
the X-Files, like,
I mean, kind of,
I mean, does it sound familiar, those of you who are fans of X-Men First Class? The idea that Xavier's seeking out government agents that are aware of mutants, does that sound familiar to you? Like, maybe this laid the groundwork of really important stuff later on.
Yep,
does it?
But yeah, it's just so, like, all of a sudden, because right now, like, up until this point, X-Men has just been like a real like second or third tier Avengers or Fantastic Four. Like, it's just been, there's nothing really that's distinguished them except that they're a bunch of teenagers, but they don't really even kind of act like teenagers. So now there's something a little bit more interesting here.
I'm so surprised that he didn't like wipe Agent Duncan's mind, or, you know, it seems like Agent Duncan knows he is a mutant. And he didn't wipe his mind. And he, at this point, but I mean, he just rode through FBI headquarters. He wipes the mind. He like Jedi mind tricks the guards at the gate. He's where they're saying, you know, repeating, "We don't remember seeing you. Have a nice day," you know? And he's in just rolling through an office, the shot of an overhead. There's easily, I don't know, 12, maybe 10 people in this shot of him rolling through the office. And he's like, "I don't have to read their minds to know where I'm going. I already do." But you know, he's wiping their minds of him going through there. He just does not have any sense of that being wrong. Like, he just roofies everybody. That's what he does.
But then the agent, think about it. If the agent has his memory wiped, then it's like 50 first dates and he's got to win him back over. Yep. Oh, he's pulling the gun again. This is going to be great. I got to convince him. But I think it's important that he knows, like, I can wipe your memory. I haven't done it yet, but I will if you step out of line.
Right.
So be cool.
If I'm bored. Yeah.
I'm feeling kind of bored. Sure, it would be nice to have a pizza right now. That would help me not be bored. He doesn't need to use his powers to manipulate people. See, he can do it through fear.
We're lucky he's so ethical.
right. Yeah.
At least one person was like, "Do I have kids?" When they got home, they didn't remember their family. Oops, went too deep on that one.
Three people fired for not, you know, they're like, "I thought I gave you that report." Nope. You did not give me that report. You're fired. Yeah. It's rough. Just anytime Professor X rolls in, somebody's
jobs will be lost.
Jobs will be lost. He's bad for the economy.
So there's our dose of X-Men for the month. Let's go ahead, take a break, and then let's talk about Avengers when we come back.
Avengers, number 46, The Agony and the Anthill.
Great title.
I saw it and I was sad, but you know, I was like, it's the, what does it say on the cover? Fasten your safety belts, true believers, because Ant-Man is back. And how? And I went, oh good, I guess I'm gonna read this now. So this is written by Roy Thomas, art by John Buscema, with Vince Coletta. And the summary is: Janet Van Dyne's chauffeur turns out to be an even bigger creep than her boyfriend, which is really saying something. He's Goliath, everybody. So the story opens in the Avengers suite, in their sweet newly decorated den, where they're all meeting and reminding the reader of all of their various subplots. Janet Van Dyne shows up with her.
I'm sorry. Do you mind if we just linger on this den for a little bit? Like, this was such a striking thing. Like when I opened up the issue and just looked at it, it was something out of like Architectural Digest or something like that of the time, where I don't know, maybe like maybe John Buscema was like having his living room redone at the time, and you know, he was just like doodling some ideas. It's like, you know what, I'm just going to throw a few Avengers on here and I'm going to get paid for this.
I'm like, a nice big shag carpet here and just a huge brick mantle. This is great. This is really working out. It does look, it's nice to see them hanging out. You know, you don't see them other than having their normal meetings in the basement, which is always, it's been described as a room with no windows in the basement. And I'm like, cool, this sounds really fun clubhouse, but this seems like they're living together.
You get to see what the conversation pit looks like.
Yep.
Their house, it looks like the house that Leonardo DiCaprio's character owns in Georgia in Catch Me If You Can.
Yes.
It's that house. It's the house that the Keens buy in Big Eyes. It's every like mid-century modern house that I would love to own.
Yes.
I would love to relax on a couch like Hercules is relaxing.
Yes. Just
letting it all breeze out.
Yeah, just getting his pits on the couch. Yeah.
Pits on there. Your sweaty pits. All you do is fight, sweat everywhere. And then he can clean up, including shaving.
Oh yeah, that's the biggest moment.
Hercules, can you robe it up before you get on the couch, please? Please.
What part of newly decorated do you not understand? Like,
yeah,
we just
this is
had this
brand new.
It looks kind of like the Brady Bunch living room if they didn't have kids. You know, if they really could just have some furniture that wasn't going to get ruined by a bunch of kids.
If it was a bed and breakfast and they just had all these people staying there. I feel like that's what the Bradys would have done if they had no children. We just like having the house full. We have people come and stay with us.
Okay. What the hell? So in the comic, Janet Van Dyne shows up with her new chauffeur, which is a violation of Avengers bylaws, of course, because Avengers have a lot of rules. And then her boyfriend, Hank Pym, is extremely ready to point out the bylaws. So, but as hard as this is to say, Hank was right. The chauffeur is actually Davy Cannon, the human top. Hal, are you familiar with the human top? Have you seen him? Like vaguely, like he's a forgettable villain. Yeah. So it's
when I saw him in all of his glory, it came rushing back. The origin story is not to be missed. It's a real page turner where he starts just, you don't really learn anything about him until he steals an apple from a local vendor. You just see him whirlwinding around, and then we assume he's a bully because some kid is like, it's a shame. He's really fast. It's a shame he's a bully. Is it? Is the speed wasted? Oh, if only he was a good guy, then I would feel better about how fast he is. But instead, he hikes my shorts up and then spins away.
Yeah, it seems like many an athlete, at least that I encountered in my you know, middle school, high school days, was not the most friendly fellow to me and the geek squad I hung out with. And, you know, but I never did think, well, that guy is really fast. It's too bad he's not nicer. You know, that right. I just, that was not, those weren't two things that crossed paths in my mind. So yeah, Davy Cannon. Oh man, what a piece of work.
Yeah. Also, just to point out, he's a mutant. It's just
establishes it. Yeah.
Yeah.
He doesn't know it. He learns for the first time.
Yeah. Is it Quicksilver who starts to suspect? I think so.
Yes.
I also like that he's got a prison name. He came, like, went into prison as the human top. Now he's Whirlwind.
The Whirlwind.
Somebody, they asked him what he was, and like the first answer he gave, which was the honest one, was not. He could see in the eyes of the other cellmates he did not give the right answer.
The human top.
Did I say human top? I'm the Whirlwind.
You don't strike me as a top.
No. Hey-o. So, and also the human tops upgraded his costume after getting out of jail, and now he's the Whirlwind, and he looks like a first draft of a He-Man character. He's got shown a lot of skin on the top, but there's straps and things, and it's just, he's just green. It's just a green costume showing the midriff, really, really rocking the 80s kind of vibe.
Well, he was working out in the yard. Yeah.
Exactly.
He does look tougher. I mean, prison did harden him up, I think. So now the Whirlwind, which is also the name of a great pinball machine, which is far greater than I think this character is and has nothing to do with it. He starts to, you know, trouble the Avengers. So the rest of the Avengers leave to go have fun. Goliath makes Wasp hang out with him in his lab because he's the best boyfriend. Suddenly the Whirlwind busts in through the wall, and with the luckiest guess ever, he just happens to activate Goliath's shrinking ray while he and the Wasp just happen to be standing directly in front of it. So Whirlwind shrinks Goliath and the Wasp.
There's some reason why they can't get big again, and I can't remember
they shrink too fast.
Okay.
And they weren't the impetus for shrinking, so they can't reverse it, but also because of that they're very tired, which leads me to ask, how long was it taking him to transform and change size before? Was it like, all right, guys, I'm ready to fight in 45 minutes.
Right.
I had an apple. I can't speed this up too much or I'm going to get sleepy.
Yep. I think I like to imagine it's like this really, I thought they were interesting Flash stories where they really got into the metabolism. He's like, I got to eat all the time to do this. And that seemed more possible. It was not everybody's favorite. My brother was like, I don't care. It's like Grand Theft Auto when you have to lift weights or something. I just, you know, to keep your character healthy. He's like, I don't care about that. Let's just gloss over that and get to the running around. I'm like, I'm really into this, him having to eat a lot of pancakes.
I'm with you. In the 1990 Flash TV show, R.I.P.
Yes.
I think it was the second or third episode. He takes a giant bowl of cereal and eats it really fast and explains, because I run so much, my metabolism's fast, so I have to constantly keep fueled. The idea of being able to eat that much cereal in one sitting is still it is a pipe dream of mine to be able to eat that much and then go, and now I need more. Yes. It's a shame he can run so fast and has to eat all that cereal. It's such a waste.
It's the worst. Bully. Danny Cannon, cereal eater.
Danny Cannon, yeah. He likes apples on his cereal. He'll mix them in. He'll steal them from the local store. That's what started him. The high of stealing that one apple that he's like, next payrolls.
So I can buy Apple Jacks. And
yeah. A local man has bought all the apples in the city. Davy Cannon. They call him the Apple Man. The human top. That's not better. He buys the apples. Can he eat them in time? We'll find out tonight at 6 p.m.
I just want to do this for the rest of the podcast now. But unfortunately, back to the ants. The whirlwind went world. Danny Cannon, formerly the human top, now the whirlwind, shrinks them, then finds them on the floor, ant sized, picks them up, and throws them in an ant farm because, you know, Henry Pym had some ants in there. He wanted to try to control red ants, which are more aggressive. So they got thrown in with those aggressive red ants, and they don't have their ant control helmets. No. So, of course not. And so now they're running around in an ant farm, and this is what the Avengers have come to. Cap and Quicksilver return because they just happen to return, but the whirlwind has planted a bomb in the lab in the meantime. So he doesn't kill them, throws them in an ant farm, plants a bomb. They're able to see that, this gigantic happening from their ant farm view. Cap and Quicksilver start to beat up good old whirlwind, but they don't know about the bomb at all. So Goliath and Wasp murder a ton of ants by stabbing them with fragments of wire. And then Goliath finds a gadget in the anthill that lets him control the ants again.
So he just Professor X's all the ants.
Right.
Yeah. It's like, pay no attention to the fact that we just impaled a half dozen of you.
Right. Do not avenge them. do not. So he rides one to a microphone and uses it to tell Cap and Quicksilver about the bomb. lucky he had that set up. Quicksilver gets rid of it just in time, and the day is saved. But on his way back to the mansion, he overhears some anti-mutant racism directed toward him, which is going to wind up being a thing.
Yes.
So that's also, we're starting to get the mutant talk more with Quicksilver and Scarlet Witch in the Avengers, and this still anti-mutant racism pieces flowing from X-Men into the rest of the universe, which is at least more interesting than the normal parliamentary procedure of the meetings of the Avengers. But it's still pretty funny.
Yeah.
Can I give a shout out to the time bomb just being a stack of dynamite with a clock on it for all yes. the technology that exists in that universe at the time? And I know it's 1967. We don't have a ton of sophisticated bomb technology that we're working off of. Everybody knows that when they look at that's bomb. And yet still, it bothers me that was the best that he could do.
Right.
It just tells Danny Cannon. How street level he is.
Yeah.
Danny Cannon, not a munitions expert.
No.
Danny Cannon spins and eats apples, and he's all out of apples.
And the whole story seems like it's written to make us take Hank Pym seriously, which is, you know, did that work for you, Brian?
it's like, I think we've talked about this before too. It's like they just keep trying to tweak things about Henry Pym's character, and I don't know. Like they change the name, they give him new powers, they take away some powers, they give him, you know, and you've messed with the character so many times. I just don't have any confidence that you have a plan for this guy. So, you know, like at that point, like there are interesting things that happen with him, but they kind of happen to him and it's much later. So, And we should also mention that the Whirlwind just gets away.
Yep. He just spins off.
He's actually got a really good record as far as Marvel villains go at this point.
Yeah, he's up there. I still don't understand why he, it doesn't matter, why he has to spin. It's like, he's fast, obviously. Like, he could just run like Quicksilver, but then he'd be like Quicksilver. So it's just Stan. I feel like Stan just, this might even be Larry Lieber days. Like, might be Stan's brother. It's like, he can't run. He's got to spin. If he's going to be fast, he's got to spin because we already have a runner. So,
yeah, I think that's part of it. I may be able to get a no prize here. So, I learned this when my child was much younger, but, kids, when they reach a certain age, like a year and a half or 2 years old, they will start doing this thing where they just like violently shake their heads back and forth. And it's crazy to watch, but then they just start laughing and giggling and everything. Apparently it's because the dizziness gets them a little high.
Yeah.
And so I think this is Davey's thing. It's like, maybe he could just run fast, but he's just so addicted to the spin.
Yeah.
Like it's the thing that like really gives his life meaning. So yeah, I think that's maybe where it all comes back
it's
to.
It's worth a no prize.
Yeah.
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 I mean,
can I tell you, do you want a no prize story?
Yes.
Yeah.
I got to visit Marvel headquarters, I want to say 4 years ago, and I got to meet Tom Brevoort, who is an editor there.
Yeah.
And my father, when I told my father I was going, I said, do you want anything from there? Because I could probably get comics or something. He said, see if you can get me a no prize.
Nice.
So I went and talked. I talked to my friend Blake, who was the one giving me the tour, and I said, my father asked if there's is a way to get a no prize. He says, come with me. He brings me to Tom's office. And Tom is like, oh, this is a very big deal. We don't really give out no prizes anymore. And then he reaches into the top drawer of his desk and pulls out an empty Marvel envelope and conveyed it to me as if I was being knighted to my father. So my father has a no prize, has an official Marvel no prize.
Oh, that's fantastic. Wow. I have a friend of mine who owned the comic book store in my hometown that I basically grew up in. He won a legitimate no prize. It was for a Spider-Man story. It was a whodunit. I can't remember what the whole thing was, but it's like he caught a mistake in it, and then he explained it in a way that said that, well, this must be the person who is the guilty person. He just happened to have predicted correctly who the reveal was going to be. But because his no prize explanation also fits so seamlessly into the storytelling, it just made it look like, oh yeah, that wasn't a mistake. We planned that all along. That was a clue. And they gave him a no prize for it. So
that's amazing.
There you go. We'll say something to take us out, Rob. And then I'll edit it.
Yeah. You'll just edit it out anyway. So
yeah.
All right, let's take a quick break. And when we come back, Brian will walk us through Thor number 146 here on Marvel by the Month.
Okay, welcome back. We are going to talk about what Thor is up to this month. This is Thor number 146, If the Thunder Be Gone. Written by Stan Lee, art by Jack Kirby, with Vince Coletta inking. Hey, Rube. Odin took away all of Thor's powers except his strength, and now he's involved with the Ringmaster's Circus of Crime. is he incorporated as the Circus of Crime?
It's a DBA.
That makes sense.
They don't have official paperwork around it, but I mean, they are allowed to be called Circus of Crime.
Well, the story opens with Thor showing off his muscles as the Circus of Crime's new strongman. They don't know that he's really Thor, but they're having him perform as Thor in the circus, which is great. And, you know, turnabout is fair play. Everyone except Thor knows that he's there to do crimes. So You know, everybody's got a secret. The show really begins on page four with a beautiful splash page of all of the performers in the circus making their grand entrance in front of a huge audience. And my first thought upon seeing this was that the crowd is just full of all the background characters that Vince Coletta didn't bother inking in the rest of the story. But if you look at like the early pages and actually everything outside of this page in the main story, it's just a lot of extremely plain backgrounds. Vince put all of his work into that one page and then just didn't bother inking any of Kirby's backgrounds the rest of it. During his performance, Thor throws his hammer through a slab of granite to impress the crowd, but it doesn't return to him because that was one of the powers that Odin took away from him. So the ringmaster hypnotizes everyone into thinking that it does return. And Thor doesn't notice him do it, but he also doesn't seem to think it's too weird that the crowd is just applauding him for picking his hammer back up. So, you know.
Is there anything more pathetic than Thor throwing his hammer? And then a pause as he realizes and has to walk like sad Charlie Brown to go pick it up.
It's pretty rough.
They could have gotten a good 12 paddles out of that, and I would have been happy just to see him slowly closing on his sad, dirty hammer.
This is a real low point for Thor. You really feel like, I mean, he's wound up working at the circus. You know, that right there is like, it's a little bit of a step down for, you know, a Norse god of thunder.
This is not the only time that his powers are stripped from him and he's sent to Earth.
No, Odin's done this a couple times already.
He took half of his power not too long, about a year ago, and he had to fight Hercules on Earth with half of his power. And that was different because he still had all his powers. They just were half, which I don't know how Odin like threads that needle when he's depowering halfway, but he did it. He's Odin.
He can do anything. If you look at him up close, he looks like Sasquatch from Alpha Flight.
He does.
That frame, I really had to look at it about 10 times. I'm jumping ahead in the story to Odin looking over them and being like, I punt it. He was disobedient, and that's the worst thing you can be in Asgard. And the close-up of his eyes, I'm like, that is Sasquatch.
Yeah.
That's 100% Sasquatch. Yeah. Don't even convince me otherwise. Odin doesn't have wild eyebrows to that extent.
Yeah. His eyebrows express, it's like the mutant master's helmet. He has mood eyebrows. They grow based on his anger.
Yes.
He's so mad he's orange.
Also, terribly inconsistent dad. Like, he's busting Thor's chops because Thor, he wanted to hang out on Earth a little bit longer, didn't want to come back to Asgard right away. And so for that, he's like stripped him of all of his power, and he's like, I don't care if the police shoot you to death. Like, you got to learn your lesson. And yet, like, his other kid, Loki, has like literally tried to conquer Asgard multiple times and kill all of the gods there. And Odin just keeps putting him on like easily escapable islands in space. So I don't get it.
It was the 60s. That generation, you know, if Thor had kids, he would never do that to them because that was what was done to him. He learned from it. Mm-hmm. That's the way generations evolve, sadly.
Yep. So anyway, the show ends, and now it's time for the real performance to begin, says the ringmaster. And what do you mean, says Thor, right before the ringmaster hypnotizes him to do some crime. And the crime that they have recruited him for is to steal a giant gold statue of a bull that's sitting in a museum. The rest of the circus crime uses all their circus skills to deal with the guards, and Thor walks in and picks up the bull and starts carrying it away for them.
There's something, I mean, maybe it's because of knowing the Unipiper, but watching that clown just run through the guards on the unicycle, just dodging, they're not shooting him because they're like, it's just a clown. Like, we can't just shoot a clown for coming into the museum when he shouldn't be here. Because apparently they had some restraint with shooting back in the 60s, I guess. Because I feel like if it were now, or let's say if it were 2015, it would just be like, shoot that clown right away. Just shoot him. But no, they have restraint, and the clown just distracts them very adequately. Yeah.
Yep.
They're so confused. He has confusion. It's like, what is a clown doing here? A clown doesn't show up at a museum. Clowns are never at museums. And yet here he is on his unicycle. Should I draw my gun? Should I just look at, am I supposed to clap? Tip a clown? What do
I do? Is this art possibly? Yeah. This is maybe performance art, time-based art here in the museum.
Yeah.
It was so much easier when I was just a gate guard for the FBI. Oh, that was so much better.
Oh, why did I lose that job again? I can't remember.
Oh, man.
Oh man, so the sound of gunfire jolts Thor out of his hypnotism. He accidentally drops the statue on poor Princess Python, and then he stays with her to protect her from the advancing police, who are threatening. It's like, hey, we know you're Thor, so we're just gonna come in shooting. And so yeah, things are not looking great. And what's he gonna do? Well, sorry, Rube, you're going to have to come back next month to find out. That's Thor's adventures. And one of the things that I was thinking when I was reading this is like, so outside of Spider-Man's origin story, the Circus of Crime is about as close as we've gotten to like pro wrestling in Marvel Comics so far. Like, you know, the whole like sideshow circusy element of it.
Yeah.
And then I got thinking like, that classic, like very like 80s, especially like Vince McMahon style wrestling storytelling. Yeah. I feel like it's very much like the 1960s Marvel storytelling. And I have to like, I wonder how much of an influence that is on it, because I mean, you've got like these really clearly defined good versus evil, you know, like simplistic, more talking than there needs to be.
Big, like, colorful outfits.
Yeah, yeah.
So you can easily identify. Like, if you took the person out of it,
yeah,
you would know who it was just from the clothing. I mean, the wrestling, obviously the superhero side,
yeah,
but the wrestling side as well. You knew who wore what trunks and who wore what to the ring.
Right.
100%.
Yeah, it's, and I don't know what happened to Stan Lee at the circus. We've said this before, but like... Nothing good ever happens at the circus, and all of carnival folk are just garbage in a Stan Lee story. So I'm not sure. There's something didn't go right there for him.
Yeah, I feel like they like left him locked on the scrambler or something. They just like a carny wouldn't let him out, and now he just hates them all.
Yeah,
it was my first time on the Tilt-A-Whirl. Young Stan Lee Lieber getting on a ride for the first time. The carny said it would be safe. But true believers, he kept me on that ride for 45 minutes. I threw up meals I hadn't had since I was 3 years old. Excelsior, I exclaimed, in a bid to get him to just stop the torture.
There it is. That's the story.
That's canon now.
That day, Stan Lee Lieber died, and Stan Lee was born.
So so there's your Thor adventure. We also have a new backup story in this issue of Thor. Tales of Asgard is out. Inhumans are in. Real quickly, the story is The Origin of the Incomparable Inhumans. It's a quick five-pager written by Stan Lee, the art by Jack Kirby, inked by Joe Sinnott, which was really nice to see. I love Joe Sinnott's inking. Jack Kirby. And so this is literally the origin of the Inhumans. The story opens in prehistoric times with ancient humans doing their ancient human things with stone tools and weapons. But then simultaneously, there's another race of highly evolved and technically advanced humanoids on Earth at the same time. And as Homo sapiens kind of rises up, the advanced species retreats to this hidden city they build called Atalan. And I just got to say, having Joe Sinnott inking Kirby on the Inhuman story just instantly makes Thor like 20% better.
Yeah.
As a book. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's like getting a little Fantastic Four backup, you know, yeah, into the, that's what it feels like.
I love the reveal of the first Inhuman that we see by the way, which is a bunch yes, of cavemen on a ridge. And then just a dude with a full on, he's like in a full, like Jack Kirby style spacesuit, and clearly has like a metal detector or something that he's reading out on, but completely oblivious to the hominids in the background.
Yep.
They're like, we hunt and gather. They're not speaking at that point. They can't talk, clearly.
Yeah.
The helmet, though, is, I mean, it's Kirby, but the helmet is, it's very weird. It looks like, it just looks like a garbage can over the top of his head. Like, it's very yes, cylindrical. Yeah.
It looks like if the trash cans at Tomorrowland were people.
Yes. So, these super evolved scientists have made an incredible discovery of the Terrigen Mist, and they're not sure if it's safe to test on a human subject. So the ruler of Adelan, whose name is Randak, declares he will be the first to be subjected to it. He steps into the Terrigen Mist chamber and to be continued. So there you go. There's your brief taste of the Inhumans for this month. I think it's good that they're pulling him out of Fantastic Four and sticking him in the back of Thor, which needs a little help right now. And it's nice to see the backstory starting to get filled out. So there you go. A fun bunch of comics this month. Now all we have to do to wrap this thing up is just talk about our panels of the month for this month. So these are the panels that jumped out at us for good or bad or weird or whatever. And I will go first. So my panel of the month is from an issue we didn't cover on the podcast, but it's Strange Tales number 163, the Nick Fury story. It's page 9, panel 1 and only. I mentioned before in the podcast that I have a piece of Steranko artwork tattooed on my body. And this is it. It's from this page. It's the dragon statuette that the Yellow Claw baits S.H.I.E.L.D. into stealing from AIM. I got that tattooed like 15 years ago. And I would also like to point out that in this panel, the Yellow Claw does not appear anywhere on the page. So I am not canceled.
So, good job.
Thank you. I don't even know where to go. It's nice that, you know, that tattoo, that piece of art does stand up. Like, that's not a regrettable tattoo.
Right.
As long as you don't talk about which issue it came from.
Right.
Ever again.
Right. Yeah.
And nobody's going to know.
It's from that super racist issue of Nick Fury.
Right. Probably yeah. You said it again, huh? Really got the detail with it. Probably shouldn't have done that.
Dumb.
Opposite of that. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Rob, what do you got for your panel of the month?
Just the splash page of Thor in the carnival. on the page 1 of Thor number 146, it's Thor lifting these giant weights just in some trunks, and smiling about it with the Gambonos, mm-hmm. doing some acrobatics on one side and Princess Python on the other. It's just such a funny Kirby thing, and the way it's posed and the time, it just looks so much like an ad for, you know, cut this out and send in $5 to learn how to get strong. It's just a nice little Kirby character piece. I could definitely have the Circus of Crime be the villain in every comic, I think, at this point. There's something about how hilarious they are, but they still did seem to be more effective than even the Masters of Evil, any mutant group. So I just seeing them come back again and Thor doing his strongman routine, it cracked me up so bad. It just stuck with me this month.
It's pretty good. Pretty good. Hal, what do you got for your panel?
That was a contender for me, by the way, Rob. I was there with you. I have two. One is from the Avengers, which is after Natasha and Clint have arrived and they're all gathered together, like they're doing the party scene in an episode of Laugh-In. I just love watching all of them sort of hanging out, some in their civvies, some in their full-on outfits, and making plans to go to baseball games or just go for a walk together.
Yeah.
That, for some reason, feels right to me. Especially the part that doesn't feel right is how awful they are to women.
Oh, just, God. Yeah.
Like, how somebody like Black Widow or Janet Van Dyne or Wanda Maximoff, how they're like, well, be sure to put on your pillbox hat and your gloves, ladies, and don't be foolish. It's all about the man that you love. That part is real creepy, but the visual of that is such a snapshot of that time that I love it. The other one, not for the look, but for the content, is the Hammer Strikes page in the Thor issue, which is all the letters written in. May I read one? Is
yes.
Okay?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Yes. Please do.
All right. Dear Stan and Jack, whatever you do, Please don't marry Thor off to that dog-faced tomboy Sif. Jeez. If you do, I'll get a subscription to Thor and cancel it. Can you imagine what would happen if they got married? Here's a typical scene at Thor's pad. Sif, honey, I'll be a little late fighting crime tonight, says Thor. Sif replies, you never take me anywhere anymore. I'm going home to Odin. Let Thor fight more menaces from Asgard like the Enchanters. By the way, while we're on the subject of Asgard, shouldn't Odin be balding? My uncle is 40 and is bald, and Odin is quite old, so he should be bald. Well, till Balder cheats at Old Maid, I'll be a loyal fan. Jeff Dunn, 709 West Locust, Bloomington, Illinois. That's right. Man. That's who you are and where you live. Everybody should know.
You just doxed Jeff Dunn.
Yeah. He did it to himself. This is public record.
Wow. Yeah. I want to pretend that's not representative of Marvel fandom at the time, but I mean, you know, it was like, that's, yeah. Yeah.
It's a lot of the letters there. Too many of them are about who, I like this lady, not that lady, but romantically, not only like which one should be Thor's prop. Here's my opinion on it. I'm a white guy who's never known the touch of a woman. Let me tell you.
I like that he's going to get a subscription to Thor and cancel it too. Yeah. Like it's like, I don't have one now, but I will get one and cancel it. That's what I'll do.
I've just been reading a friend's comics, but now I'm going to start spending money on it to stop spending money on it. That'll show you.
I like to think that he threatened initially the first draft of the letter. He was going to threaten to cancel a subscription. And he's like, I don't have a subscription. Damn it. They're going to look that up. They're going to know. There's going to be no teeth to this threat. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, ooh, how do I really give this legs? Oh, I'm going to get a subscription. I'm going to threaten that I'm going to get one, but then I'll cancel it. So they'll know the joy of me subscribing. And then the pain of the cancel. Oh, I'm going to write this right now.
amazing representative samples of this crazy month of comics. Last thing left to do is just recommend some things that are not 1960s Marvel comics that we may want to suggest that folks read. My recommendation this month is a little off-brand for us, but I picked up Matt Fraction and Steve Lieber's Superman's Pal Jimmy Olsen, Who Killed Jimmy Olsen trade paperback the week that it came out from our local shop, Books with Pictures, which meant that Fraction signed it and Steve sketched in it, which is pretty cool. And honestly, this thing is one of the best things I have read this year. It's really hard to do a funny comic book. It's a lot of folks have tried, and Not Brand Eck is proof that you can really go badly off track with it. But these guys, they absolutely killed it. And it captures that lunatic sense of nonsense of the DC Silver Age, just in a really joyful and celebratory way. And it's so refreshing to see that coming out of DC these days. And they also do a really good job of just taking the piss out of Batman, who's had it coming for, quite honestly, a very long time. So I'm totally in favor of that as well. Highest recommendation.
Nice.
Yeah, what do you got, Rob? Yeah,
that's great. Well, I couldn't find a good way to connect this, but I've been wanting to, since we've been talking about recommendations, we talk a lot about where we left superhero comics, in the 90s. And part of that was Vertigo. And you talked about Sandman on the last issue. And the thing that grabbed me the most from DC's Vertigo run was Grant Morrison's The Invisibles, which is an entirely different take on superpowers. It's, to me, I guess it could be an analog towards like the X-Men, but it's like the weirdest powers, like doing drugs to travel through time. And I think some of the official genre of it is science fiction and anarchist. So it's like, it touched my heart. And the fact that it was, people with powers, but just doing the weirdest things with them. It's hard to even talk about their powers, but it's very British. And it's centered around the sort of Illuminati style leadership of the empire, being controlled by Cthulian sort of, dark lords through a different dimension, and they're fought by these sort of punk rock, you know, team of ragtag team. That is a really just scattered way of defining it, and I feel like it might even be an appropriate way of defining, trying to define the Invisibles. But it is one of my favorite comics. I recommend it. It ran from 1994 to 2000. There are so it's a finite collection, and it was running towards sort of the apocalypse of 2000. So it was built as this countdown to that end of the world.
Sweet. Hal, what would you recommend to our listeners?
I'm going to keep it in the Marvel family. I don't know if somebody's already recommended this, so apologies if I'm retreading. But this is a series that that began with Avengers number 311 and ended in Amazing Spider-Man number 329, which is the Acts of Vengeance. It took place over the course of about 3 months. Has this already been covered?
No.
Well, I'm the first? Yes.
Yeah.
Essentially, the idea is a mystery villain has gathered together a council of villains, and they together break out a bunch of smaller villains and then match them up against heroes who they haven't faced before. The idea being that the heroes have not scouted them, so you get great moments like Thor throwing Mjolnir at the Juggernaut and it's stopping when it hits his body because he can't be moved. And, of course, the mystery person, we talk about retconning or just having a long memory, but the to spoil it a little bit, you've had over 20 years to read it, 30 years now. The mastermind turns out to be Loki, who is desperate to destroy the Avengers, especially because he's the one that caused them to unite in the first place. Best moment of the entire series is Magneto fighting the Red Skull, because Magneto's a Holocaust survivor, and the Red Skull is the ultimate Nazi. But it's a really, really great series that carried for a good amount of time. And it was like right in the sweet spot of me really getting into reading Marvel comics at that moment. So I have fond memories of it, and I hope you will enjoy it too.
That's nice. That was also my Marvel Comics sweet spot when I was really getting hardcore into Marvel Comics. And Marvel is just doing a really nice, they've done two of the three volumes already. I think the third one's coming out in just a couple months, but of nice trade paperback collections of all of it. So,
oh, wow. That's great.
So those are available right now. So
get them.
Nice. Get them. Hal, thank you so much for joining us for this episode. It has been an absolute delight to have you on the show.
Oh, this is my pleasure. Anytime you want me back, just sound the call and I will be there.
Oh, awesome. That's wondrous.
With these weird lights that I will have figured out how to make a stationary color the next time I record. People can't see this, but when there's a picture of us, who knows what color my frame will be.
Right.
It depends on how I'm feeling. It's, you know, we've established.
Yep.
You'll have to guess.
Are you the mutant master, perhaps? You have...
you wouldn't
say.
You have to tell us if you are, otherwise it's entrapment.
That's true.
Yeah. I know we talked about a couple of your shows up at the top, but one more time, give us a round of plugs. What can we get our listeners to check out that you're up to these days?
Sure. You got the podcasts, which the big ones are Thrilling Adventure Hour and Welcome to Night Vale. Those are great to listen to anytime if you haven't listened to them before. There's a great back catalog for you to explore. Also, the main ones are We Got This with Mark and Hal, that I host currently, along with Tights and Fights, a wrestling podcast. Those are both on Maximum Fun. Good Morning Night Vale, which is on the Night Vale Presents Network. But also, Mark and I did a live show on December 10th to benefit Lyft, which is a charity that empowers families to break the cycle of poverty. And that show is available for you to purchase for a pay what you can to charity on houseseats.live through the holidays. So it's the two of us with Paget Brewster talking about some of your submitted holiday topics, plus some really great musical performances that people did for us. So that is houseseats.live. And there are tons of great shows to find on houseseats.live, another of which I may be in coming up. But I don't want to ruin it. It hasn't been announced yet as of this recording, so I don't want to announce it and then be wrong. Sure. 2 days before Christmas. That is not the way Santa Claus intended it.
That's not how he rolls. But yeah, no. We'll make sure that links to all of those wind up in the show notes for this episode. So yeah, definitely check it out. Sounds like it's for a very good cause, and I have no doubt that it's absolutely hilarious also.
And in addition to that, I want to fawn over Welcome to Night Vale. I was very podcast ignorant. I very music focused. So when I have audio time, I usually am doing that. And Brian has definitely converted me. But before Brian even had to convert me, I had heard through other channels, both Super Ego and Welcome to Night Vale. And that is like an old time radio show, you know, you're doing, and it is such a funny premise and so understated in how it's delivered. It's just brilliant. And, so the whole show and in general, I would recommend, but now I'm definitely going to, be checking out. Is it Good Morning or Good Day?
Good Morning, Night Vale. And if you like old time radio, check out Thrilling Adventure Hour.
Oh, yes, I will.
Yes. Yeah.
And Super Ego also such a great show. Oh my God. So good. I think about Super Ego and quote it in my brain at least once a day. That is the truth.
Yeah, I did a road trip with my friend who made me listen to every episode of Super Ego on like driving down from Portland to the LA area. So it was so fun. My face hurt as much as it does right now after getting to do this episode with you. So it's great.
Thank you.
Awesome. Well, as far as our stuff, Apple Podcast reviews or any platform that lets you review a podcast, why don't you give us the best possible review you could possibly give us? And hey, if you take a screenshot of that and then email it to marvelbythemonth@gmail.com, we'll put some free stuff in the mail for you. You could do that like our listener Nick did a few weeks ago when he said, I think I found Marvel by the Month via a sponsored post on their excellently curated Instagram. It's quickly become one of my favorite podcasts every week. Thank you, Nick. And hopefully by now I have remembered to send you something because as of right now, that hasn't happened. But I swear by the time this episode airs, you should have something in your mailbox.
And currently the Marvel by the Month empire consists still of Brian and I. So all editing, all music, all, you know, we do everything. And Brian runs the best Instagram. It cracks me up every day. Yeah.
Well, and you can check it out at Marvel by the Month on Instagram. It's a blast. Like just putting screenshots and snarky captions of crazy 1960s Marvel comics. It's the job I was born to have. And you can also hit up marvelbythemonth.com, links to our other social accounts there, as well as our shop, which you can get the you can't get it in time for the holidays now. But hey, you can start out the new year, maybe, if you go right now to marvelbythemonth.com, order yourself the Stay Inside and Read Comics Mjolnir t-shirt that Rob designed, which is a absolutely wonderful piece of art that you can have on your body.
Or you can get it on a mug or a duvet cover or it can be on anything. Just imagine.
Imagine the possibilities. Well, that's pretty much it. So until next week, my name is Brian Stratton.
And mine is Rob Milne.
And we hope that you will stay safe, stay healthy, and stay inside and read comics.